In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The Word became flesh and made His dwelling among us. John chapter 1, verse 1, skipping down to verse 14. Now that's how you begin an essay. I mean, you got a little power paper due, a little sleeve thing to write. Dude, this thing is still in publication, like over 1,000 years later. This is hardcore beginning to an essay. So I was just thinking, if I was going to start that off for like one of your classes, what would be a great way to contextualize it? I thought something like this. In the beginning was the TA. And the TA was with the professor. And the TA wanted to be the professor. But the TA became sketchy and made his dwelling among the freshmen. Maybe not, I don't know. It loses some of its zing in the translation. But tonight we're talking about Jesus and the Bible. The Word made flesh and the Word made text. The Word of God in its two expressions. Last week we got distracted for a bit by a spider invasion. So if you'll allow me to recap. First, actually, I'm going to ensure that doesn't happen again. Who knows what this is? Who can identify this device in my hand? Yes?
It's a bug zapper. It charges perpendicularly wires.
Yes.
It's a high voltage, and so if a bug, you spawn a bug with it, it'll
yeah.
charge both wires at the same time.
If you hit both these buttons,
it's fiery death.
Yes, fiery death for a bug. Now, this is also a paddle. And so I figure we've got in our room the person I know who hates spiders the most, who's also most adept with paddles. So Esther, you're our defender tonight. If you see a spider coming, or if anyone else sees a spider descending from on high, only if she pushes both buttons. So you just might want to avoid. So, hit both buttons at once. And don't touch anybody while you're doing it. That's right. There'll be a little light that comes on in the front. 1,000 volts or something. No, I'm just kidding. I'm kidding. It won't kill anybody. Just a bug. So I think I should probably recap since we had the little ninja spider onslaught last week. For the last few weeks, we've been talking about the Bible. I began by explaining the Bible's claims about itself. Now, that's not circular reasoning. It's an appropriate place to start. You let the defendant speak first in any sort of a trial. They give their side of the story, then the cross-examination comes. So the Bible spoke for itself and made some pretty high claims. Basically, that it was the Word of God, that it was reliable, and that it had the power to change your life. So we began looking how plausible are these claims. 2 weeks ago, basically there's only three criticisms that can be leveled against the Bible. One is that it's been corrupted or changed over the years and it's not what it's supposed to be. That's one. Another is that it contains errors external to itself, like history, science, math, something's wrong in there. And the third is that it contains errors internally. It contradicts itself. So the second, 2 weeks ago, we looked at the whole transmission thing. And we found, I think, that there's absolutely no way you can seriously believe that there's major error in the Bibles we have today. In fact, the rational belief is they're at least 99.99% pure and probably perfect. Last week, we looked at the other two categories, external error and internal error. And we saw that even those who propose errors in the Bible, the ones who are intellectually honest, do so tentatively. And that a lot of the perceived errors really don't stand up under close examination. And I sent you guys out, who are part of our email list, a list of critical websites. And really what I think are the fiercest and most credible critical websites of the Bible, along with the rebuttal websites, and invited you guys to take a look and decide for yourself. And this week, it's like, you know, you have Star Wars, you know, the Empire Strikes Back. This is the Bible Strikes Back. This is the counter-examination. This is why I trust the Bible. See, all I've done so far is defend against the negative. And that's only good up to a point. I mean, if I'm just giving you reasons not to believe, the reasons not to believe, that may work in math, two negatives make a positive, but in the rest of life, that's not quite it. There's got to be some actual positive reasons for believing the Bible. And I'm going to lay out for you what I think is the simplest and honestly the most functional argument over history for trusting the Bible. Now, if you've been around the church world much at all, you probably think you know where I'm going with this. You're expecting me to whip out all the fulfilled prophecies, maybe talk about a little Bible code, do some other supernatural stuff in the Bible. I'm not really going to do that, or at least I'm not going to build my case on it. The reason is that most people actually just don't find that persuasive at all. Let me give you an example of two real, solid, biblically fulfilled prophecies and show you why I think that it's not persuasive to most people. You got the case of Tyre, the city of Tyre, as in Tyre and Sidon. This is a city existed on the eastern seaboard of the Mediterranean long, long time ago. Now, in Ezekiel chapter 26, you've got a very, very detailed prophecy that appears. Now, we're not going to read this. Don't worry. But, I mean, this is detailed. And it makes some specific predictions about what's going to happen to Tyre in the next few years. First, it says, very soon, King Nebuchadnezzar is going to come and defeat it. That later, another nation is going to come and scrape Tyre down to the very rock upon which it is built, that it would become a place where fishermen spread their nets to dry and that it would never be rebuilt. That's the essence of this. It's Ezekiel 26, 1 to 14. You can look it up after the meeting if you'd like. Now, here's the amazing thing. That's what happened. About 10 years after Ezekiel wrote this, Nebuchadnezzar did come attack the city. But see, the people of Tyre have this little slick technique. There was a little island fortress just off the coast. And so whenever there was a really big army coming, everybody would bundle up and head out to this little island fortress, and it'd be like Monty Python and the Quest for the Holy Grail. Aha, I fought in your general direction. You know, they just taunt them, and then they tear stuff up and leave. They rebuild the city. And so Nebuchadnezzar won, but he didn't really destroy the city. Then, 250 years later, along came a man named Alexander, whom we know as Alexander the Great. Turns out he got that nickname for a reason. He was able to do things that no one else was able to do. So Alexander the Great's leading his army along. They're coming up towards Tyre. And sure enough, they run out to the little island fortress. And what does Alexander do? He says, it's not over yet. It's on. And he began to have his soldiers rip down every building in town to their component bricks, hauled them out to the ocean, and dumped them in to make a land bridge that went from the shore out to the island, went around, besieged the city, conquered it, and he was the first guy to really thoroughly conquer Tyre in that way. And the thing is, in the process, he did scrape it down, throw it into the sea, just as the Bible said. And to this day, I am given to understand, I've not been there myself, but the old city of Tyre has not been rebuilt because Alexander changed the shoreline. And so the new city that's been rebuilt that bears its name today is in a different place. And the old place is still flat rock, and some fishermen do use it to dry their nets. That's pretty amazing. Why don't most people find that persuasive? Because that's a big deal. Like, you see, there's two kinds of biblical prophecy fulfillments, right? There's the inside the Bible prophecy fulfillment, like all the stuff about Jesus. Well, it said he'd be born in Bethlehem. And most people are like, yeah, but the Bible is the one who said he would be born in Bethlehem and that he was born in Bethlehem. That's like the left hand saying, right hand, you're so great. And the right hand goes, yes, I know, I'm wonderful. And that's not persuasive to most people. So, but even this, like, this is the fulfillment outside the Bible, right? But did you know that stuff about Tyre? No. I mean, who here heard the story about Alexander the Great before? See, like, you don't know to trust me or not. You got to look that stuff up. So most people, when they hear that, they're like, yeah, maybe. I'll look it up later. And do they ever look it up? No. And so they just remember, some guy said this thing and it wasn't that persuasive. Now, there's others. Like, for example, the one that I think is impressive to most people because it just bears on the real world and it's stuff we know, if you're at all aware of current events, is the nation of Israel, right? Restoration of Israel as a nation is really an amazing thing in the Bible. Now, this happened just in 1948. So this is around 60 years ago that Israel first became a nation again after 2,800 years or so, I believe it was, of existing without their own self-governed homeland. And the Bible talks about this a lot. Here are just two of several examples in the Bible of prophecies that talk about the restoration of Israel. Ezekiel 11:17. Therefore say, this is what the sovereign Lord says. I will gather you from the nations and bring you back from the countries where you have been scattered, and I will give you back the land of Israel again. Isaiah 66, verses 7 and 8, describing the way that Israel will be restored. The way that Israel will be restored. Before she goes into labor, she gives birth. Before the pains come upon her, she delivers a son. Who ever heard such a thing? Who's ever seen such things? Can a country be born in a day? Or a nation be brought forth in a moment? Yet no sooner is Zion in labor than she gives birth to her children. Now this is kind of poetic language. You got to decode it a bit. But the bottom line is, the birth of Israel is going to be sudden and easy, and then trouble will ensue. Now that's not normal. I mean, think about how nations get formed. Like if I wanted to make my own nation here in Northern California, I think that George Bush might have a few opinions about that. And I have to deal with the 82nd Airborne, right? Among other, you know, massive militarized forces. Israel, on the other hand, the way it was formed, just look it up. Boom. Paper signing. It happens. It's there. And peace is there at the beginning. And then from about a year or two after that till now, we've had major trouble. The birth, then the labor pains. Now, that's still somewhat impressive. In fact, I'd say that's pretty darn impressive, especially when you think that this was not a vague prophecy. This is pretty detailed, and there's a lot more of them that I don't have time to get into tonight. And it's about something that's extremely improbable. I mean, this is about a nation that for over 2,000 years did not exist. That it will be recreated in the exact same place that it used to be. And it's going to happen in this particular way. Why is that still not convincing? To me, at least. Well, you know, all that proves is that the Bible knows the future. Big deal. I mean, I'm impressed, but that doesn't mean it's trustworthy. I mean, my broker might know that a stock is going to go up or down tomorrow due to insider trading. Doesn't mean I can trust him. He may give me bad advice. Here's a thought game. You believe in Satan, maybe. Suppose Satan wrote a book and it knows the future. Does that mean you can trust his book? No. The trustworthiness of the Bible is independent of the fact that it's got this stuff in it. Now, that's nice and it's good to know. It kind of builds our faith. But ultimately, it's not the thing that's most persuasive to most people. Very few people that I know have come to Christ because of an argument like this. In fact, this whole series I've been doing on the reliability of the Bible has not primarily been to persuade non-Christians to become Christians. If that happens, it's great. But mostly, it's for a lot of believers who've had their faith knocked around at Stanford being told this and that about the Bible. And I'm trying to show you that, in fact, what you've been told, there's another side to the story. And it's not the slam dunk case that people have made it out to be. The Bible can be trusted. So how is it that most people actually come to trust the Bible? Well, it has to do with trusting Jesus. Now, I don't know if you guys have kept up with the news at all, but lately there's been this big story about the alleged corruption or the desecration of the Quran by United States forces in the interrogation of prisoners at Guantanamo Bay. If you've been keeping up with the news at all, basically the story goes, some interrogators took pages from the Quran, ripped it off, and flushed it down a toilet. Now, you need to understand the impact that has on the Muslim psyche. Very bad. In fact, riots then broke out in the Middle East, and I believe 15 people died as a result. And I mean all over the Middle East. Now, it turns out the story was false. The paper that issued it said, oops, we used a bogus anonymous source, we're sorry. 15 people are still dead. But now, what would happen at Stanford, though, if one of your professors took a page from the Bible and flushed it down the toilet? Would you be annoyed? Yes, I assume. Even a lot of non-believers on campus would think that was a little bit over the line, a bit inappropriate, unless it was like performance art or something. But are you going to riot? No. And if word gets out around the world, is any place in the world going to have a riot because of that? No. I mean, what's new? We know that a lot of professors think the Bible is crap and should be flushed down the toilet. Thank you for giving me a visual illustration of what I've known you believed all along. That is great. But why aren't we going to? Because there's a profound difference about the way that Christians view the Bible than about the way Muslims view the Quran. I can illustrate it this way. Muslims don't trust the Quran because they have trust in Muhammad as a great prophet. Muslims believe Muhammad is a great prophet because the Quran says he is. It's completely different. Muslims believe that the Quran existed up in heaven before Muhammad ever wrote it down. And then the book came down, not literally, I don't believe it floated out of heaven. I mean, it was relayed to Muhammad and he wrote it. But that it was already existing and that he transcribed it perfectly. And it said nice things about him, and that's why Muslims believe nice things about him to this day. Contrast that with the Bible. We don't believe in Jesus because of the Bible. We believe in the Bible because of Jesus. How do I know that for sure? Well, just think about this. The last book of the New Testament, the book of Revelation, was probably not finished until somewhere in the 90s AD. Now, Jesus died 30-something AD, right? So that's about 60 years that passed. 60 years. You could have been born after Christ died and rose from death, lived a life, converted, and died without ever even having had the chance of holding a full Bible. For that matter, think about all the people who became believers on the day of Pentecost in the book of Acts, chapter 2, verse 42 to 46. It talks about all these people converting. Now, for 20 or so years after that, 25 years or so, from that day, there was not a single piece of the New Testament written. Not a letter of Paul, not a single gospel. Now, do you think some of those people probably died in those 20 years? Oh, yeah. Seems likely. They never even heard of the Bible. Were they believers in Jesus? Absolutely. The Bible is not a prerequisite to faith in Jesus. In fact, for most of you who converted at some point in your adult, you know, young adult life, did you convert because you had done this intensive study of the, you know, the epistles of Paul? And be like, yes, I'm now convinced that this is hermeneutically and exegetically insightfully correct and that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the... No. I'll tell you what I can almost be certain happened in your life. A friend of friends revealed Jesus to you, either through word or deed, or probably both. You began to have respect for Jesus. You trusted Jesus as he showed them, as they showed him to you. And then, as you learned more about Jesus, you learned that there was something connected to the book about him, and you began to look at the Bible. And as your trust and confidence in Jesus increased, so did your trust and confidence in the Bible. That's the way it's happened through the ages, and that's the way it goes. It's the way it should be. Because the Word of God is much more important than the words of God. Now, I'm not saying the Bible's, you know, substandard or grade B or whatever. I'm just saying that there's a reason that in Christianity, God gave us himself to understand. I mean, what's a word for? Like, if I use the word pen, what am I doing? If I had hidden... Okay, listen. I use the word traveling clock, traveling alarm clock, which is what I have right here behind the desk. You each have an image in your mind of what I'm talking about. You know what it does. You haven't seen it, unless you were really quick while I grabbed it. But you're able to conjure up the image. A word is to help you put a picture of something in your mind without having to experience it yourself. Now, that's very important when you're talking about an omnipotent, omniscient, omnibenevolent being who is invisible, that no one has ever seen directly. If we're going to wrap our brains around this God fellow, if we're going to try to figure out anything more than Aristotle was able to figure out, that there was some unmoved mover, that there's some force out there. By the way, Star Wars opening tonight. Hoo-yah! There's this glowing entity or something. If we're going to actually understand anything meaningful about God, we have to have something to wrap our brains around. So God said, I will make myself most understandable to you. I'll become one of you. And if you like me in human form, you really like me. And if you look at me in human form and you decide you don't like me, it means that that's as understandable as I'm ever going to be to you, and you've decided you don't like that. And so you don't like me. The Word of God is what it's all about. There's a reason God just didn't drop a book out of heaven. He dropped himself out of heaven. So, how can we kind of express this sort of bullet point format? I think it would go like this. You just kind of come to the Bible to learn more about Jesus. Why would you do that if you're not a follower of Jesus? Well, he's the most influential person who ever lived. Now, I'm not qualifying that. I'm not putting a footnote. He's one of, he might be. No, clearly, Jesus is the most influential person who has ever breathed, whether you worship him or not. Now, you disagree with me. All right, give me a counterexample. Muhammad, no. Fewer people follow him today. And he's had an impact over world history for hundreds of years less than Jesus has. Besides which, he's not been responsible for the great flowering of Western culture, which is today the most dominant culture in the world, owing to the influence of Jesus. Jesus has been influential in the advancement of women's rights, the advancement of civil rights, the eradication of slavery, all these amazing things. Clearly the most influential being who ever lived. So you want to learn more about him. So you go to the Bible, because it's the only place that talks about Jesus in detail. And you just come to it as a purely historical text to learn more about the deeds and words of this magnificent man. Now, as you do that, you begin to learn more about him. And you begin to gain respect for him. You trust him. Then, as that trust grows, you notice that he trusts the Old Testament. And so you start to think, well, if I'm trusting this guy as one of the most moral and influential figures who ever lived, and he's saying this is his source of morality, or one of them, maybe I should take a look at that too and give it some credibility. And then you notice that he trusts his disciples to perpetuate his teachings effectively. You say, well, maybe I should take a look at what they wrote too. He put confidence in them. Maybe they're worth a shot. And as you do that, a spiral begins where trust begets trust begets trust begets trust. As you put to test the claims of the Bible made by Jesus and his followers, and you find them credible. Now let's just step through this bit by bit. Take a look and see where we wind up. So first, you come to the Gospels for purely historical information about Jesus. Well, now, a lot of people have problems with that step. How much trust can you put in these purely historical records? I've heard some pretty negative things about them. I mean, if Jesus is so amazing, then why didn't any other, like Roman historians, write about him? I'm glad you asked. As it turns out, quite a few did. There's Tacitus. Tacitus, in his Annals, 1544, says, "Hence, to suppress the rumor that Nero set fire to Rome, he falsely charged with the guilt and punished Christians, who were hated for their enormities," whatever that means. Christus, the founder of the name, was put to death by Pontius Pilate, procurator of Judea in the reign of Tiberius, but the pernicious superstition, repressed for a time, broke out again, not only through Judea, where the mischief originated, but through the city of Rome also, where all things hideous and shameful from every part of the world find their center and become popular. Sounds like San Francisco. And then he goes on to describe all the tortures that Christians endured in Rome under Nero in 64 AD. There's another Roman historian, Suetonius. He lived from 70 to 160. He wrote the lives of the emperors, and in particular in the life of Claudius, 25:4, he writes, "Because the Jews at Rome caused constant disturbances at the instigation of Crestus, he, Claudius, expelled them from the city of Rome." Now, this is interesting specifically because this is the same expulsion that's mentioned in Acts 18:2. Just kind of an extra biblical confirmation there of something we knew happened. Now, this is the most amazing, Josephus. He lived from 37 to 100, and his Antiquities 18:3-3, he writes, "Now there arose at this time a source of further trouble in one Jesus, a wise man who performed surprising works, a teacher of men who gladly welcomed strange things. He led away many Jews and also many of the Gentiles. He was the so-called Christ. When Pilate, acting on information supplied by the chief men around us, condemned him to the cross, those who had attached themselves to him at first did not cease to cause trouble, and the tribe of Christians, which has taken this name from him, is not extinct, even today." And in 29:1, he writes, "So he assembled the Sanhedrin of judges, and brought before them the brother of Jesus, who was called Christ, whose name was James, and some others. And when he had formed an accusation against them as breakers of the law, he delivered them to be stoned." Now, what's the significance of these three quotes? By the way, that last one, you can Google for these. You can check them all out. I gave you the references. This last one, you will know if you go online that it's in a different form from most of what you see. That's because the form that you see most is even more outrageous than this. It's like, "And he was the Son of God." Most critical scholars believe that that particular sentence was an add-on. Being that Josephus was not a follower of Christ, he probably would not have written that. But this is the thing that most scholars are pretty sure he actually did write. This is what people say about him. This is what I've heard. Now, what's significant? These are the only three Roman historians that we still have texts from who wrote about this part of the world in this time. 100% of them mention Jesus. And they mention Jesus in a way that corroborates, not undermines, the gospel accounts. What specifically do we learn from this? Because it looked kind of vague. No, we learned some very specific things. That he was reported to perform amazing miracles. He had a reputation as a wonder worker. That some thought he was the Jewish Messiah. That he was put to death on a cross under Pontius Pilate. That, understandably, slowed the movement down for a while. That it was then re-energized to the point that Christians voluntarily went to their very painful deaths less than 30 years after Jesus was killed. And incidentally, in response to current criticisms, they also attest that Jesus was the founder of Christianity, not Paul or some other ancient religious leaders some modern scholars seem to believe. And they agree that it started in Judea. It's not some conflation of all the mystery religions floating around the Roman Empire. That's a lot. Now, does it get us everywhere? No, of course not. But I find it interesting that, in fact, we learn quite a bit about Jesus from secular historians. And that what we learn makes us think, you know, this gospel account? Largely credible. So you come, you begin looking at Jesus. And maybe you filter a few things out, maybe that didn't happen. But you just look and Jesus said this. This is what his closest followers heard him say. Eyewitnesses. In two cases, and in two cases, people reporting what eyewitnesses said. So you take a look. And as you take a look at Jesus, you begin to discover some pretty astounding things. First, he's just cool. I mean, all the big party people, the party animals in town, would flock to Jesus and hang out with him all the time. But not only was he cool, he was also smart. All the religious scholars would seek him out and ask him religious questions. And he would zing them. I mean, they would, you know, they'd be like, "All right, how can we sell?" It's like you do with your professor sometime. "I wonder if I asked this question." And he was Johnny on the spot, man. Boom. And they'd be like, "All right, not asking Jesus any questions anymore today, man. Pack it up. Let's go home." He was amazing. He was also really subversive. So much so that his society wound up putting him to death. And then he makes these absolutely outrageous claims. I mean, he's the man. But that's the problem. He's claiming to be much more than a man. I mean, he says stuff like, "I'm the only way to heaven. I was alive before Abraham was." You know that guy who lived 2,000 years ago? "Before Abraham was, I am. The prophet Moses told you to do this." You know Moses, founder of your whole religion? He said that. "I say do this now instead. Everything that God has is mine." Wow. All authority in the universe belongs to me. No one, right before he was killed, no one can take my life from me. I'm doing this of my own free will. I have the power to lay it down, and I have the power to pick it right back up again. And perhaps most astoundingly, I am the resurrection and the life. The one who trusts in me will never really die. These are remarkable claims, and they're core to what he teaches. They're not like incidental throw-ons. They're like the weave into the everything that he's all about. Absolutely astounding. And then he makes some even bolder claims. Come to me, and I'll give you rest. My yoke is easy, my burden is light. Why is that bolder? It's testable. You can try that. He says, ask and you'll receive. Seek and you'll find. Knock and the door will be open to you. You want to know if God exists? Seek. You'll find him. You want God to do something for you? Ask him in prayer. If it's not stupid, you know, Lord, give me the ability to kill all my enemies. You know, if it's something, you know, that God generally approves of, he'll do that. I have come to help you become fully alive. And I've come to give you freedom. You begin to wrestle with these statements. You hear them, and then you observe them lived out in the lives of people you know who follow Jesus. And your trust level increases. You begin to test them out, and you find yourself over time oozing into the kingdom. And you're becoming more and more sort of an admirer of Jesus. And you're moving from an admirer to a fan, and from a fan to a follower. And one day, you come to a crux. And you make a choice. Look, this is crazy. Either he is who he says he is, or he's not. And you go all out. You say, I'm going to give it a try. He's my Lord. I'm going to follow him. He's my leader and my forgiver. Jesus, take over my life. That's what it means to be a Christian. To make him your boss and to follow him. And then things actually change. Like you give him your life, sort of like a Hail Mary pass, and he catches it. And amazing things happen. And so then you're like, I got to check this guy out even more carefully. You start looking, and then you notice two things. He really does take the Old Testament very seriously. He quotes it all the time. And he tells other people to do what it says. Some guy comes up to him and says, hey, teacher, what's the essence of morality? What does it take to be really good? He says, what does it say in the Old Testament? Well, it tells me to love God with all my heart, soul, mind, and strength, and to love my neighbor as myself. That's right. Go do it. It's easy to say it. It's hard to walk it. Go do it. He takes the Old Testament at face value and puts great trust in it. So if you've already got trust in Jesus, you're like, well, hard to believe he's boss of the universe, but he doesn't know what he's talking about. So I'm going to trust the Old Testament too. And then you notice, not only does he trust the Old Testament, he implicitly places trust in the New Testament that's not yet been written. He says, all this I've spoken while still with you. But the Counselor, the Holy Spirit, whom the Father will send in my name, will teach you all things and will remind you of everything I've said to you. John 14, 25 to 26. In other words, he's making a promise to his followers. You know what? Someday you're going to be able to write this down. And God's going to make sure you get it right. And before you know it, you've gone from trusting Jesus to trusting the Bible. And as he often does, that pesky old rabbi has taken you much further than you ever thought you'd go. Jesus is amazing. And that's it, really. That's how most people throughout history who've trusted the Bible have come to trust it. And I would like to reassure you tonight. Has your faith been troubled by something here at Stanford? Fine. Investigate it. Maybe there's some stuff about the Bible that you misunderstood. I mean, it's an easy book to misinterpret. Just because your professor said something you believed is wrong doesn't mean the Bible's wrong. Either your professor's wrong, or your understanding of the Bible is wrong. Or maybe an understanding of a third unrelated fact that applies to both. Investigate it. But as long as you've got trust in Jesus, have trust in this book. Because your trust in the book flows from Jesus, not the other way around. I just want to close tonight with a word about Jesus. He really is worthy of trust. The wisest choice you can make in life is to put your trust in him. Trust, belief, faith, whatever word you like. It reminds me of a story of a missionary that I heard once. He lost in the jungle. Not a good place to be lost in. There's things that eat people in the jungle. So he stumbles around until he finds a village. He finds the village so gratefully, gets in, gets some water, some food, and then he hires a guide and says, can you take me out of the jungle? And the guy says, sure, no problem. And so they just start walking. and they're walking, and they're walking, and they're just in the jungle all around, no path, no sign of civilization. After an hour or two, the missionary's starting to get really worried. Hey, man, where's the path? How do I know we're going to get out of here? And the native just turns around and says to him, Bwana, in this place, there is no path. I am your path. And that's the same claim that Jesus makes. There is no path in this jungle called life. There's no road mark that's guaranteed. But there is one who walks with you. One who said, I am the way. One who said, I am the gate. And I invite you tonight, if you have not yet, to place your trust in him. The way you do that is very simple. You just believe what he said. Put confidence in him. And then say, however much you can do for me, I want you to do that. And boom, you're a Christian. Join me in prayer.